Hello, this is Congressman Jim Clyburn, and I would like to welcome you to my podcast, Clyburn Chronicles. I've always been a lover of history. I see this platform as a way to connect history with the politics of today. This is so important because, as George Santayana once said, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Each episode, my guest and I will have a conversation about the lessons of the past, the politics of the present, and how we must learn from those experiences to help shape the future. Thank you for taking time to listen, and welcome to Clyburn Chronicles. Hello, I'm Congressman Jim Clyburn, and welcome to another episode of Clyburn Chronicles. Today, I'm joined by a very special guest and a good friend, a former mayor of Columbia, South Carolina, and current director of the White House Office of Public Engagement, and senior advisor to President Biden, Steve Benjamin. The first 3 years of the Biden administration have been arguably the most productive of any administration since President Lyndon Baines Johnson and his Great Society programs. And now we've had other administrations since. I've supported it. The Clinton administration and the Obama administration, to name two Democrats, George W. Bush, and not to mention 45. But when you look at those things, even the Affordable Care Act that we got under Obama, this president has come up with programs that are unrivaled by anything since the Great Society. The first 3 years of the Biden administration have been arguably the ones that have put us back on track. And if legislating is not enough, this president has decided that it's one thing to get these things done. It's something else for people to know what's been done and people to know how to access that which was done. And so he decided that it was in his best interest and the best interest of this administration to find someone to put into his Office of Public Engagement, someone who knew what it was like to need these kinds of service, and someone who has brought himself up. He had enough sense to leave New York, come down to South Carolina, get himself an education, because his parents, of course, were natives of South Carolina, though he calls himself a New Yorker. When he comes back home, he gets involved in the community. He develops relationships with people who know and respect him, loved him as a public servant. Joe Biden saw in him the kind of person he needed into his Office of Public Engagement, and he brought Steve Benjamin, former mayor of Columbia, into his office. Steve not only was a leader here in South Carolina, he has served as president of the United States Conference of Mayors back in 2018 and 19. He's been president of the African American Mayors Association. He's been executive chairman of the Municipal Bonds for America and with various other intergovernmental and nonprofit organizations. Steve Benjamin is a good friend of mine, and I'm happy to have him with us today. And I am going to turn it over to him now to make whatever introductory remarks he would like to make, and then hopefully he'll answer a few questions for me. Steve?
Congressman, you know how you know, the deep amount, well, of respect and affection our family has for you, for the leader you've been, for the man that you are. I love when I meet people who just started paying attention to South Carolina in 2020, and the more of the world was exposed to the work that we've seen you doing in amazing ways for decades. And I've told you before about my belief in you as honestly one of the most consequential public officials, I believe, in the history of this country, because we've seen you operate on the biggest of stages and, more importantly, in places where folks who no one knows your name, they've needed you on some very basic things. We're not even talking about 21st century infrastructure like your leadership on broadband, but some places where people just needed clean water. They need the roads that work. They need the opportunities, and no one else is paying attention. This is way outside the 6th congressional district, outside the places where you had full responsibility, and you've always been there. And I'm so glad to be able to stand in your shadow over the course of my professional life, and certainly to be here with you today. I love how you always lead with a history lesson, because people, that's one of the biggest challenges we have right now, is that I think folks don't really connect where we come from, where we are, and even more importantly, where we can go if we go together. It's been almost a year. April 4th will be a year that I've been here at the White House working with the president in public engagement. And for folks who don't, who've never interfaced with the office, and hopefully this will be the first introduction, and we'll have opportunities to spend some time with many of you in the past. The Office of Public Engagement is meant to be the front door to the White House. So you have folks who work with the congressmen and members of Congress, and work with governors and my former colleagues, mayors and others, tribal nations. We deal with everyone else in civil society. So business and labor, civil rights groups, LGBT groups, faith groups, veterans, young people, older people, just about 40 different portfolios out of this office. And every single day, it's our job to do the two things that I think are most important. My grandmother would say, you know, God gave you 2 ears and 1 mouth for a reason. You listen twice as much as you talk. It's one thing to go and tell people the great things that are happening under the administration's leadership, under the president and vice president, working with folks like Mr. Clyburn in Congress. It's more valuable to actually be able to listen and get constructive input, constructive criticism from people about, okay, this is what's happening on the ground, where real people are working every single day to live up to their God-given potential. Is there some way in which this program might be able to be exposed to more folks? Are there ways in which this might be able to change so people get access to the opportunity? I will tell you, just as the congressman, and we'll have a chance, I guess, maybe there's some question and answer. The journey that the country's been on under President Biden's leadership has been nothing short of historic. Think about from whence we come, and I know a lot of us probably have we all suffer from some trauma coming out of the greatest pandemic since 1918. Some predicted maybe the greatest economic unrest since 1929 and the Great Depression, and the greatest social unrest we saw probably since 1968 after the murder of George Floyd. All wrapped up into a couple of years under the president's predecessor. And stepping into that situation, realizing that there need to be some really bold moves put in place that are going to change the trajectory of the country. And the president laid, the congressman laid out the American Rescue Plan. I mean, literally think about the things that matter most, cutting child poverty in half, getting the American economy back up and running. Some prices are still too high, but getting inflation down from 9.1% 3.1 to 3.1%, literally the very best economy in the G7. The infrastructure bill. I'm a former mayor, as the congressman referenced. We used to come up here for infrastructure week every other month. It was always an infrastructure week, and now we got almost a $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, 50,000 projects all across this country, helping improve infrastructure. You think about it conceptually. By 2030, every single lead pipe in this country will be taken out of the ground and replaced. And the generations of poisoning families and children all across this country will be over. But the infrastructure bill, I dare say the American Rescue Plan, could have been something that any one president could have used as a reason for re-election, all the successes there. But then you got the infrastructure bill, then you got the Inflation Reduction Act with all the amazing benefits, particularly in healthcare, but also, you know, the largest investment in clean energy and climate change in the history of the world, and the CHIPS bill that the congressman mentioned. I'm not sure anyone paid attention to, you know, how important semiconductor chips were in our lives until the pandemic hit, and you couldn't get anything. You couldn't get phones, you couldn't get cars, you couldn't get anything. And making the very affirmative decision that we're never going to be subject to that again. We're going to use our resources to incentivize building jobs and factories right here in the U.S. for Americans to have great jobs. And we've seen over $600 billion of private sector money come into that space and create, gosh, we're at 50, almost 15 million new jobs. Unemployment at historic lows. At one point last year, the unemployment rate was at 4.7% for Black America, which was the lowest it's ever been in recorded history. You know, in the 50-something years we've been keeping these statistics. So all four of these pieces of legislation, and then just making sure our job is make sure people know about them, people can access them. Working with men and women, congressmen like you and your colleagues, getting the word out, and then getting broader than that, and really trying to get to every nook and cranny in urban, suburban, and rural America, and make sure folks see the benefits of what's happening here is our task. And we got a great team we've been able to assemble here that reach out deep, get outside the beltway. Sometimes it's very easy to get stuck here, but you got to go out where real people are doing the things, that great things that they do, and use that to inform our decision making up here. And it's been meaningful. And I think about, and I'll stop. And I think about the policies that we're doing. Not only have these policies and programs been thoughtful and meaningful and creating incredible wealth in our communities, you know, more Black businesses starting for the first time in 30 years, but they've been also very restorative and reparative. Congressman, I heard you when you mentioned President Eisenhower's you know, infrastructure bill, you know, the reality package. The reality is that we're going back now and fixing a whole lot of things that the last generation of American infrastructure destroyed. I mean, you know, whether it's reconnecting communities in Milwaukee or Atlanta, or you go to Columbia and see the remnants of communities destroyed and divided. I started paying much more attention to the history of that. When you had the footbridge built over 277, and people are like, well, it's nice to connect those communities. You're like, there used to be one community, but we took a highway right through it. So this emphasis of reconnecting communities and understanding that not only does that create jobs, but it connects families, people with their historic houses of worship, their schools, and in the restorative and reparative way, some of this policy making has been done very thoughtfully in partnership with you and other members of Congress, in partnership with the president, vice president. It's a wonderful time to be here, and we got to make sure we continue to get the word out so we can finish the job.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Well, I won't call you Mr. Mayor, but thank you, Steve. I'm glad you mentioned that pedestrian bridge over Highway 277 outside of Columbia, because I think it tells us a lot about this administration. You know, when I was growing up, much less so when you were growing up, but when I was growing up, there was a fond saying of which side of the track you were born on. And because the railroad track running through towns defined, it was like a line of demarcation. Black folks on one side of the tracks and white folks on the other side of the track. And of course we got away from that when we started building these interstate highways. But what happened? No protection for these communities. And in many instances, Tulsa, Oklahoma, I was down there when we were commemorating the anniversary of the Tulsa riots. right through the middle of that town, a big interstate highway, just busted up the communities. And what happened in Columbia, when they ran 277 through that community, they had all the people living on one side of 277. They were going to schools on the other side of 277. There's a little 7-year-old girl that got killed running across that highway that got to me. And she was one of 7 or 8 people to get killed on that interstate highway. This administration, thanks to Joe Biden, he says those things were wrong. We're going to go back now. We're going to spend money with this infrastructure bill to tear down those walls between these communities. Tear those highways out and reconnect these communities. And that's a thing that everybody seemed to miss with this administration. And I'm glad that you brought that up. And you may want to expand upon that.
Yeah, I mean, you think about it. I mean, that again, my introduction to that major flaw and what we saw as infrastructure and trying to make sure folks who are going to the suburbs and the suburb beyond the suburb and the suburb beyond the suburb could get to downtown with ease. And you know, Milwaukee, where the president announced this new $3.3 billion grant just a few weeks ago, Congressman, 17,000 homes destroyed when they built that highway, 1,000 businesses destroyed. You think about generational wealth. You know, what was lost when those businesses were displaced? I mean, you know, I mean, and you know Columbia even better than I do. You know, we go down by our Coliseum, Ward 1 community, and you learn about the churches that all used to be there. Now they're all around Columbia because they were displaced, during urban renewal. Same story, different projects. But the opportunity through this $3.3 billion to reconnect these communities in Milwaukee, I guess it's maybe $150 million or so in Atlanta, you know, did the same thing straight through Sweet Auburn, impacted other communities too in Chinatown and in Philadelphia, right through their Chinatown. So capping it and allowing for this very special place. People often, I'm an infrastructure lawyer by training who plays politician, but the idea that the public realm, where people congregate, where we have a chance to actually know each other, be with each other, and create the sense of civil society, is very important. And when you destroy that, you destroy a lot of different things. So when you go back and you try to restore it and repair it, it's very powerful. And so $3.3 billion was the latest announcement just in that space, projects all across 40 states trying to go back and reconnect communities. And it's doing the right thing, doing the smart thing. And I believe it's going to change communities and put some communities back together.
Well, I'm glad that we got a chance to talk about that because, you know, I've heard a lot of discussions about what this administration is or is not doing. And we respond to those discussions or participate in them with a litany of things. But quite frankly, this is the first time that I've been part of a discussion of this type, reconnecting communities. We talk about it, but we never really have a full-blown discussion in the public about how important it is, symbolically and substantively. Absolutely. When you reconnect these communities, you give people an opportunity to interact with each other. You give businesses a chance to grow and flourish, and you improve the lives of children being able to really go to school in their communities rather than getting bussed out of communities. I've heard you tell the story about having to be bussed outside of your community. Maybe you want to share. Yeah, I know I'm the history guy. You don't mess with history too much, but I think that some of my listeners would love to hear just your impression of what it was like to have to be bussed. And this wasn't in the South where you were being bussed.
Oh, absolutely. No, it was. And you would think about it, in the Southern context. My parents, I remember telling Reverend Jackson back when I was president of the African American Mayors Association's congressman that my parents, I said my parents migrated from South Carolina to New York. And he said, Mr. Mayor, he said, your parents weren't migrants. He said, they were refugees. And I stopped for a second. He said, you think about, and you've known so many of your colleagues at SC State, folks you grew up with in Sumter or with the high school or school with in Camden, so many people who left. Because left the places they love, left the people they love, left their culture, because their opportunities that they wanted to have for themselves and for their children, they didn't see them at home. So they moved, obviously, our pathway, from South Carolina was New York, New Jersey, Philly, and the like, and we still maintain those deep bonds between communities. My family moved to Southeast Queens, and it's where I was born and raised. And you would think, I mean, I walked to my elementary school, and obviously in this great wave of trying to integrate schools, which still you think about, and this is the 80s in New York City. This is not a 1954, in Clarendon County, South Carolina. We're talking about the 80s in New York City. We still had to be bused into Howard Beach. And for people who are students of history, if you know the story of Howard Beach, it was an incredibly challenging place for anyone of color to be at that time. And maybe even now, I've not been there in quite some time. But we were required to be bused into what was then Robert H. Goddard Junior High School. And it was a place where, there were ethnic clashes on a regular basis, and if you messed around and you missed your bus home, you had to walk home, and it was never a pleasant experience trying to get to places of safety. But this is not long ago. I mean, and people tend to think, if they haven't decided to really become students of history, there's this haze and this distance between from whence we've come, and the reality is that we are so proximate to the struggles. And I love the way you engage with people and you spend time with people. You're a very proud Black man, but and I am as well, and I love telling the story of the African seed and American son from my perspective. But when you go through these struggles, it allows you to also see the dignity in everyone else's struggles. You can hear so many similarities between just people who have been challenged or oppressed all around the world throughout the annals of time and history, and it makes you think that much more of a better public servant. Now, I made the decision after going to junior high school in Howard Beach and not appreciating the environment, to go back to high school in my own neighborhood, which is overwhelmingly African American. It provided a base of safety and security and nurturing, and a place where we were able to excel academically before I matriculated at the University of South Carolina with Jennifer and the others. But that experience is formative. I mean, and for depending on the young person, depending on the house where they come from, if God let me pick my own two parents, I couldn't done a better job. My dad and mother are still my heroes to this day. But depending on the environment you're coming from and how supportive it is, being in those hostile environments as an 11, 12, 13-year-old, they can make or break you. And I watched a number of my peers who could not navigate that, and they were already living in situations like a whole lot of kids that we're working every day hand in hand to meet the needs of. They couldn't make it, and it was powerful. It was powerful, informative. Growing up there, when I came south to Columbia, my family roots, as you know, are in Orangeburg, South Carolina. I was able to connect with so many wonderful people who then served as incredible mentors for me, directing all this pent-up energy I had, causing trouble in the high school, and directing me in a way in which we found ways to organize and gather folks around really, really good causes. And then obviously you were then and remain a shining example for so many of us is the how to lead thoughtfully, principally with principles, but also very pragmatically, recognizing that the people that we fight for every single day, yeah, they want a whole loaf of bread. But sometimes if you're working to make sure we get them a 3/4 of a loaf or nothing, we got to get them 3/4 of a loaf. And that takes a whole lot of relationship building, a lot of pragmatism. And what I've enjoyed about working with you, I know that was not the purpose of this conversation, but you're always able to look down the road, Congressman. There was a time when honestly, nobody else was talking about broadband but you. I mean, I'm serious. I mean, we have a conversation. We're talking about, I don't know, reconstruction. And you start talking about broadband. We're talking about the Great Society, and you start talking about broadband. But you saw something around the corner and obviously, you know, we've heard stories about the Rural Electrification Act, and you saw that as the great equalizer. And this is all way pre-pandemic, when everyone finally realized, yeah, we had to be connected in order to access all the things that we needed. But you've always been able to look around the corner and see things that people needed, even for people thought they needed it, and then to stay the course to make it real. And I've always appreciated that about you. It's been a wonderful journey, brother.
Well, thank you very much for that. You mentioned Jennifer. Listeners may not know Jennifer, the mayor, former mayor, referred to my daughter. Jennifer Clyburn Reed, to some of you may know her as Dr. Reed, but you all were classmates, I believe, or know you were at the university together. And quite frankly, I learned a lot from you guys. As you say, we got two ears, one mouth, and so I kept one ear to you guys, another ear to my generation. But I learned so much from you all. And I tell people to this day, I listen a lot, I talk to young people, and I listen to young people, and I learn from them. And you said something just that reminded me of a scripture. I grew up in a parsonage, and my dad, a fundamentalist minister, always thought I would follow him into the ministry, and I thought so too. But when I told him, I did not think I was going to go to the seminary, as we talked about, he said to me on that occasion, "Well, son," he said, "I suspect the world would much rather see a sermon than to hear one." And I've tried to use the scripture that I learned from him and still study. And just yesterday, when I was talking down there in Berkeley County, I went to a passage of scripture that you just reminded me of. I think it's Proverbs, I believe, the 29th chapter, around the 18th verse. We are said, where there is no vision, the people perish. And so I try to be visionary in my service. And that's what the internet stuff was all about to me. I remember when we got electricity in our home, and I read this book by The Next Greatest Thing, where a man giving testimony in a rural Tennessee church one night that said, "Brothers and sisters, let me tell you something. The greatest thing on earth is to have the love of God in your heart. But the next greatest thing is to have electricity in your house." I've never forgotten that. That's what I saw with the internet. And I called it the next greatest thing is to get connected to the internet. That's the way to get healthcare into rural communities. Mm-hmm. And if people everybody had been connected, so many of our young people would not have lost a year of school when the pandemic hit. So telehealth, telemedicine, whatever we want to call it, stay-at-home education. In fact, I've got a son-in-law now, my grandson-in-law, who is an engineer. My granddaughter, who worked for you at one time, is now a pediatrician. Her husband is an engineer. I don't know, every now and then he goes to his office down there in Houston, but he's up in D.C. With her, working remotely.
That's
the
awesome.
internet makes that happen. And he's making a tremendous contribution to his firm, but he only occasionally goes down to Houston. That's the way the world today. And so if homes are not connected, businesses are not connected, they're not going to be able to compete. And so that's just what the internet is all about. And that's why I'm so pleased that your administration, when we did the infrastructure bill, decided to make the information highway, the internet, just as important to that bill as the interstate highway. And $65 billion in the internet to make it accessible and affordable is building out. In South Carolina, we are not going to have a single home or business not connected by next year this time. That's a great plan.
And make sure folks know that's not everywhere. Now, mind you, this money is going everywhere, rural, suburban, urban, but back to you and your partnership with the president, congressman, and your partnership with the governor and the rural electric co-ops, everything else, that groundwork you did put South Carolina in the position to be ready to move quicker than everyone else. And I saw a report late last year. I think we might have seen it together. It showed the penetration that we'd had in South Carolina vis-a-vis other states. And I mean, this is going to be a game changer for the next generation of South Carolinians. And hopefully people understand not just the gravity of the move there, but also kind of how we got there. And I'm glad you laid it out for folks. You're looking around the corner. I'm waiting to see what the next big deal is that you're gonna vision out, and then I'll be in the private sector.
Thank you so much for that. But look, I went down to Berkeley County and talked about rural water down in Berkeley County, a tremendous $24 million addition we're making to that water system down there. So I said, I'll stay here, go to that groundbreaking so nobody else will get the credit.
Because they'll vote no, and they'll show up at the groundbreaking and the ribbon cutting and everything else. You got to go make
exactly
sure
right.
That's exactly you got to make it.
Because I'm the only one in this state that voted for that bill. Everybody else voted against it. But now they're all running out there with the press releases, showing up for the groundbreakings, taking the pictures. But that's what this is all about. This administration, and I thank you so much for your role in it. But I'm going to just say to you, I called you last week, or it may have been earlier this week, I don't recall, just to share with you conversations I've had with people in the last several days. I've been amazed at the number of people who said to me, that Steve Benjamin is just who this administration needed in that particular position at this particular time, having been a mayor for three terms, right? That's 12 years of mayor. The mayors out there appreciate you so much. You're being able to bring your experiences to them, for them to be able to feel that they can come to this administration through your office, gives them a sense of participation in what we're doing that they're very, very pleased with. And so I want to close today by offering you an opportunity to make any closing comments. But I also want to just say to you that it makes me real proud when I hear so many people offering these glowing assessments of your service. It makes me proud to know you.
Congressman, I'm humbled, as you know, to spend this time with you. And I have had my blessed experiences over the course of my life too. And it allows me to come to this position of authority with a just a deep sense of gratitude. You know, it's tough being tough to be mean and nasty when you realize you've been blessed beyond measure. And I've had so many people who poured into me over the course of my life that when I come to this job and I realize the opportunity we have to help so many other people live up to their God-given potential under these amazing policies that you have helped the president and the vice president move through Congress. We're fundamentally changing lives. I like to hear my peers say that. Obviously, it helps my soul. But it's because I also know, you know, I'm a brick in the foundation, Congressman. I'm wearing you remember Ms. Danella Brown Wilson? You know, we go take her to vote. I'm wearing her a pair of her husband, Reverend Wilson's cufflinks today. And, you know, whenever I'm in a place or a space where I feel like last night, I feel, you know, history's in the air, and then I knew I'd be talking to you today. I wear these just to remind me, man. Just to remind me of whence I come, of who's I, not just who I am, but whose I am. And then it kind of steps into your I'm sure you can see these steps in the red too. I'm not gonna get the Kappa versus Omega. I'm gonna leave that alone. I'm not gonna win that argument with you. But it reminds you of who you are, whose you are, and then your obligation to make sure that every single one of these babies who may not be born as a Benjamin or a Clyburn or what have you, but wherever they are, wherever zip code they live in, they ought to have that same opportunity to live with the God-given potential. And that's our job, to make sure that our policies create that environment, that our work makes it real for them. So I'm honored to be here. I'm so honored to work here in the West Wing with this president who's been doing amazing work. And I know that, but for your labors and men and women just like you around this country, and he'll tell you this, I know that, he would be where he is right now. And that is reflected in every single policy that he's pushed either through executive order or legislation since day one. And we just got a lot more work to do, man. And I'm happy to be in the arena, just working to fight for people every single day. But thank you, brother. Thank you for all the things you represent to all of us, Congressman.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for your friendship. And Claude, thank you for bringing up Mrs. Wilson, because as we close today, I want to say to everybody, all my listeners, how important it is to vote. I'm not going to tell you who to vote for. Vote for whoever you want to. But please participate. Vote. And you brought up Mrs. Wilson. This reminded me. I shall never forget when her daughter, Minnie, who I saw a couple of nights ago, called me and says, "You know, Mama just turned 100 years old." I said, "Yes, I know." She said, "Well, she's about to turn 100. I said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, she wants to go vote with you on her 100th birthday." And she didn't say, "No, you don't have to pick her up. Just meet us at the polls. She wants to cast her vote on her 100th birthday with you." I should never forget that. And every time I hear people saying they don't have time to vote, they shouldn't vote, here is Mrs. Wilson, Reverend J.R. Wilson's widow, at 100 years old. She had to go vote and wanted to vote along with her congressman. And I wish people would just get that kind of attitude about participating. I have no idea who she voted for that day. I hope she voted for me, because I was on the ballot that day. She voted. And she was not going to let the day go by not voting. Please vote. Remember,
amen.
Reconstruction came to an end by one single vote. Jim Crow became the law of the land by a committee vote of 8-7. 8-7 by one vote. If the vote had been 8-7 the other way, Jim Crow would never become law of this land. That's how we got Jim Crow, by one vote, an 8-7 committee vote back in 1877. That, to me, is the power of one vote. Amen. And you have demonstrated the power of one personality time and time again. I thank you so much for the contributions you made to South Carolina and the contributions you're now making these United States of America. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to another edition of Clyburn Chronicles.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Clyburn Chronicles. If you enjoyed this episode, please let us know by leaving a comment. And don't forget to subscribe to my show wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. Until next time, I'm Congressman Jim Clyburn.